All right, thanks for sticking it out, everyone. We're at the last presentation, so here we go. So this is the National Immunization Survey teen data from 2007 to 2013, looking at doses of HPV vaccine among males and females. And so we all know, or probably all know, that HPV vaccine rates are not what they should be. It's a three-dose series, and so when we look at rates with one, two, and three doses, we see okay numbers in females with one dose, but when we look at the full series, we're sitting around 35% of females with three doses of the HPV vaccine, so having a complete series, and that's in adolescents age 13 to 17 years. So when we look, this was actually a separate study looking at HPV vaccine coverage in Washington, and this was actually a poster that was up yesterday and today. So we see that same type of pattern in adolescents, especially adolescent females who get one in three doses by age 18. But when we break down the numbers into on-time doses, which is receiving a dose during ages 11 and 12, you can see that real plateauing effect where we don't see the same increase in on-time doses as we see in all doses. So this is concerning. And among males, the vaccine was only approved a few years ago, so we're still seeing uptake among males, but it is slow. So there have been previous studies looking at reasons for this poor uptake, and one major finding from studies in the past has been that a strong healthcare provider recommendation is a key predictor of increased vaccine uptake, and that healthcare provider recommendations do tend to increase with increasing age. Among both patients and parents, the delay of vaccination has been cited as the most common cause of non-vaccination. So when kids go in for their 11 to 12-year-old visit and they get their Tdap and meningococcal and they don't get their HPV vaccine because they choose to delay, they just never go back in and they never receive that HPV vaccine. And then when other studies have asked providers why this occurs, why this delay in vaccination occurs, providers commonly cite reasons related to parental concerns. And when studies ask parents, they relate to lack of physician recommendation or the perception that the vaccine is optional. So clearly we have some communication issues here where the blame is sort of being passed around, everyone's sort of passing the buck on this. And then in a study that Rebecca Perkins et al. Did entitled Providers' Perceptions of Parental Concerns About HPV Vaccination, she found that negative perceptions of parents' views may lead providers to decrease the strength of their recommendations, secondary to feelings that parents are not interested in vaccination and that providers have little ability to influence parental behavior. So the goals of this project were to characterize pattern recommendations for HPV vaccine in Washington, to characterize any knowledge gaps or needs that still remain in our state, and to identify areas for improvement in these HPV vaccination discussions between parents and providers and their patients, and how to better promote the vaccine, and to make recommendations to our Department of Health for future interventions. So we conducted a provider survey. This survey was based on six previous surveys that had been written in the past in other states, and we adapted that for our city goals and for use in our state. And we assessed provider recommendation practices by patient age group and sex, perceived barriers that contribute to missed opportunities, needed educational materials, and the general perception or knowledge about the HPV vaccine, as well as the most interesting part that I think came out of this study is topics used to discuss the HPV vaccine with patients and parents. Our target population was any provider in Washington who provides healthcare to adolescents. So we ended up distributing the email or the survey by email through four different professional organizations with Washington chapters. These included the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Academy of Family Physicians, the Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and the Academy of Physicians Assistants. We also did attempt to survey ARNPs United, which is nurse practitioners, the National Association of Pediatric Nurses, and the Congress of OBGYNs, but for various reasons we were unable to survey in these groups. So we sent the survey to almost 4,000 providers who were members of four different professional organizations. Of those 4,000 people, 542 opened their email. And so a little bit of an issue with an emailed survey. So I'm jealous of Jasmine's 21% response rate. We had a 13.6% response rate, but that's actually very similar to what has been seen with emailed provider surveys. Our response rates did vary by a professional organization, with our lowest response rate among naturopathic physicians and our highest response rate among physician's assistants. When we look at our demographics of respondents, clinicians could choose their specialty as part of the survey, so this isn't just associated by which member organization they were with. We found that the vast majority of them were family practice clinicians, and we did have a fairly even age distribution across the spectrum. One thing to keep in mind when we look at these results is the majority reported 0 to 20% of their patients were adolescents, so these may be people who see a smaller population of adolescents. And the majority had 0 to 20% of their patients with public aid or no insurance, so maybe seeing wealthier populations. The majority of our respondents were female and had an average of 18 years of practice. Over half worked in private clinics, and our average clinic size was 18 providers. So this is our first set of results here, looking at recommendation patterns for HPV vaccine among eligible patients. So you can see in blue we have 11 to 12-year-old females, in red is 13 to 18-year-old females, in green is 11 to 12-year-old males, and in purple is 13 to 18-year-old males. So very few providers reported that they never recommend the vaccine, so that's a good thing. But you can see that we do have some variation in how providers report recommending the vaccine by both age and gender. And in fact, all age-gender combinations were significantly different. So different providers were always more likely to recommend to females and always more likely to recommend to 13 to 18-year-olds. And so overall, more than 30% of our adolescent healthcare providers report not always recommending the HPV vaccine to eligible 11 to 12-year-old patients. So we are able to use data from the previous study that we did that looked at vaccination rates by county to correlate that with provider recommendation practices in that county. And we only use counties where we had at least five providers responding to the survey in that county. But you can see with the R-squared value, so in red we have males, and 28% of the variation in the proportion of county 13-year-olds who have at least one dose of HPV vaccine can be explained by the proportion of providers in that county who always recommend the vaccine. And among females, a similar statistic is 20% of the variation can be explained. So you can see the p-values did not quite reach significance on this, but again, we had low numbers as far as the number of providers in each county that we are able to look at. So I think with some larger numbers, we might see some more significant findings here. So then when we looked at reported barriers, our most frequently reported barriers did reflect that perceived parent or patient concern about the HPV vaccine. So again, these are physician-reported barriers. And these included limited parental knowledge or education on HPV or HPV vaccine, and parental mistrust of vaccines in general as our major barriers. And an example of a patient concern is patient fear of pain or needles. We also included an open text box for providers to list other barriers, and the most commonly listed barrier was a lack of healthcare visits at this age. We asked providers about their perception or knowledge of the HPV vaccine, and most clinicians do say they believe that the vaccine will have a positive impact on adolescents' lives, and most clinicians do believe that the vaccine is effective. About half of clinicians had received education or training at their employment site about HPV or the HPV vaccine, and most clinicians report that they did know the ACIP recommendations. Okay, so this is looking at provider discussion patterns when they discuss the HPV vaccine with patients and parents. So we asked physicians how strongly they emphasize each of these topics when they were discussing the vaccine with their patients. And so the good news is that more than 80% reported that they do strongly emphasize prevention of HPV-related cancer, which is a good message that we think physicians should be promoting. But 50% of physicians or providers reported strongly emphasizing the prevention of HPV-related cancer in sexual partners. 30% emphasize higher vaccine efficacy in younger patients, and 61% emphasize the importance of vaccinating before any sexual activity. We did a little bit of logistic regression looking at predictors of always recommending the vaccine, and we found that pediatricians have significantly higher odds of always recommending than other provider types, and unfortunately, naturopathic physicians had a 96% lower odds of always recommending than pediatricians. Younger providers were more likely or had higher odds of always recommending, as well as providers who saw more adolescents or more patients who had public aid or no insurance. So our limitations were our poor response rate, certainly, as well as response bias, both in that providers who felt one way or another were probably more likely to respond to the survey, and then providers probably also perceived that there are right answers to certain questions. And we did also have some missing provider types, not including nurse practitioners and other groups. The analysis that we did looking at the vaccination rates by county, by provider recommendations, that was a very ecologic analysis, so it's hard to draw really definitive conclusions from that. But overall, we did have a large sample size with almost 500 respondents. We did include varied specialties, and our results do corroborate findings from other studies. And the assessment of patient-provider discussions has not been done very often other than in a focus group setting where providers may alter their discussion patterns. So in conclusion, continued educational efforts for providers are crucial, focusing on best practices for discussion of the HPV vaccine with patients. We really need to keep pushing the recommendation to discuss this vaccine as cancer prevention and not as STI prevention. More than 60% of providers were talking about this and emphasizing strongly the importance of vaccinating before sexual initiation, as opposed to talking about the effectiveness in younger patients. And so, in my mind at least, it makes sense that parents are choosing to delay when providers are talking about sexual initiation with the 11-year-old patient. So that's really some education that needs to go on there with providers on how to present the vaccine. And so overall, we need to figure out some ways of changing this negative clinician perspective of parent views, or ways to respond in spite of this perception of negative parent views. Almost 75% of providers said that a huge barrier was parental mistrust of vaccines in general, but we know that parents are going in and they're getting Tdap and they're getting meningococcal, so there's something different that's going on with this HPV vaccine. And so I think it really comes down to educating providers on how to have this discussion and how to present the vaccine in a positive way to parents and their patients. I'd like to acknowledge all of my colleagues at the Washington State Department of Health, as well as the authors who previously had done work like this on whom I based this survey. And this was supported by CDC CSTE Applied Epidemiology Fellowship. Thank you.
Thanks, Hannah. That was really great. And these great surveys, you know, and the response rates is really very frustrating. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's really kind of important to plug away and you know, kind of looking at the responses over time in aggregate with a lot of other surveys, because mm-hmm. it really does help validate what you do, because we have to make decisions based on, you know, some level of validation and really kind of stay with it with this vaccine. Other questions? Yes, Susan.
Hi, thanks for this. I know people are asleep, but thanks for this presentation, and is a compliment to your poster, your nice poster. Can you remind me again the time that you did the study, the months?
Yeah, it was done from June to October of 2014.
Okay, so sort of still at the beginning of the big national efforts to try to educate providers, mm-hmm. and so I think it does really, so we have some people, you know, sort of feel like, well, we're saying the same message over and over again, people aren't, like when we're talking to providers, you know, we need to move on to something else, but I just think you're right, it shows that there's still a lot of work to be mm-hmm. done, fine-tuning, you know, how providers are thinking about communicating with parents.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
Yeah. And Washington State did receive a grant to work on some of these communication pieces, and so a lot of that work is being done, and these results have been shared with the group that's working on those grant objectives. But yeah, I think it's very telling that providers are giving us these responses as far as how this communication is occurring with themselves and the patients or parents. So there's still a lot of work to be done, you're right.
Thank you.
David?
Dave Kunder from AIPHP, and this stuff is great, and I'm wondering about the action steps. It's a very emotionally charged topic, and I think that if you ask parents what they hope for their children, which is why it's so emotionally charged, the answers you will get depend a lot on the question you ask.
Mm-hmm.
The question, would you like your child to someday have sex, is a different question from would you like your child to someday have a life partner, is a different question from would you like your child and their life partner to be protected someday, which is a different question from do you want grandchildren? But we can be pretty confident that somewhere north of 99% of our young people will eventually have sex with somebody. And I think as parents, we really do want all those good things, mm-hmm. even though we're ambivalent about the messy parts and concerned about the hazards. And I don't always have the confidence I need to be able to address that with what turns out to be a pretty sophisticated contingent strategy where you start the dialogue one way, you see what response you get, and then you're ready to go in several other directions. All the time your own emotions are churning inside you as well. I'm glad the younger folks are more confident about this. I suspect we all need better skills. And it sounds like people want better skills. So I'm really looking forward to how this translates into action in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Question. Are you planning to follow up with the parents to kind of compare them with what the providers were saying?
So I don't have plans to do a further study at this time. There have been studies, asking parents similar questions about perceived barriers, and a lot of times those do relate back to that conversation that they have with the provider where the provider either didn't recommend the vaccine or they thought that the provider made it seem like it was optional. And I think this comes back to the previous comment as well, that these are, you know, very emotional discussions, and it depends on how the vaccine is presented. But I think we have to recognize the fact that it's sort of the provider is the one who's in the position to be educating and to be trying to guide that discussion and trying to teach parents. And so I think the parent side of it is a very important thing to learn how they perceive, but I think our efforts need to really be focused on educating the providers, because presenting the vaccine as cancer prevention that is effective, you know, at this age, and it truly is effective the earlier that it's given, and avoiding some of those harder, more difficult conversations, I think is the way to go. So, but I'm not a provider and I'm not a communication specialist, I'm an epidemiologist, so what do I know?
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you had any feedback from providers with regard to actually communicating with the patients directly, with the adolescents, because we've been trying to figure out in New Jersey, we want to actually communicate more out to the teens and get them to be the ones that want the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, actually pushing more of that STI part of it, like, you know, cancer down the road, a lot of kids don't have that on their mind, but they really don't want genital.
So in your situation, are the parents present or not present?
I don't think they have to be present.
Right. Yeah, so I think it is a different conversation if it's only patients who are there, and patients cite reasons like fear of pain or needles. So I think there are some very real things, you know, a provider can talk about, you know, the potential HPV-related cancers, and if a kid is willing to get a flu vaccine, I mean, if to me at least, cancer is a lot scarier than flu. So I mean, you know, I think there are ways that the provider can present that. But also, I think there are a lot of important messages to teens that haven't really gotten out there yet as far as how this disease is transmitted, because it's not like a lot of other STIs that would require anal or vaginal or oral sex in order to be transmitted. This can just be skin contact, and that's a lot different, and it may affect a lot younger population. And so I think there are other messages that and risk messages for teens that need to be out there as well, because it is different than other STIs, so that does need to be communicated.
Okay. Anyone else?
I just want to make a comment.
Chaz is my mentor. She's not allowed to make a comment.
Chaz has something to say right now.
We have a physician at Madigan who has a grant to do provider-to-provider education, and this is just an anecdote. He was working on a slide for provider-to-provider, and he had a slide about oral cancers in males and HPV preventing that, and he said he had a patient come in, a mom, with her 11-year-old boy. And he goes, well, let me just show you these slides. And he showed her the slides of the oral cancer prevention. She said, we're getting it today. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just think that's really, that was just so compelling to me.
For sure. Yeah.
I'm a bit jealous because this wasn't AAPHP's idea, but on vaccines, the California delegation of the AMA brought forward something endorsing parent-to-parent peer education. And it looks to me like there may be some opportunities there, and that was adopted as new AMA policy this month. So folks who are looking for innovative ways should be aware that there is some potential opportunity with support of pediatricians and physicians in general to move ahead with parent-to-parent education. Thank you.
Well, thanks. I want to thank all the speakers for their great presentations and for all of you to stick it out this far. And it was a very, very important topic. And, you know, keep going with it. And thank you.